28. Bella was not ungrateful for the rejuvenation that the Fountainheads had bestowed upon her, but even alien science had its limits. The days tore by as quickly as they ever had. Faster, perhaps, now that the metronome tick of sleep had returned to her world, its nagging beat a constant reminder that there was always more to be done, never enough hours in the day, never enough days in the year. No one could honestly say that they felt immortal. No one had returned to the Fountainheads for a second rejuvenation, and while Bella had little doubt that the aliens would oblige if asked, it was unclear whether the process could be repeated indefinitely. And sudden, violent death was still as much of a problem as it had ever been. What might once have felt like an acceptable risk to an 88-year-old woman now struck her as the utmost foolishness when so much was at stake. She dreaded any business that required her to fly, even though there had only been one fatal lander accident in the last 33 years. In the new climate of forgiveness and reconciliation, there had never been less risk of assassination from Barsegian loyalists or other rogue elements. Yet still she spent hours tightening her security arrangements, as if every crowd concealed a knife man, sniper, or toxicologist. Months passed, and her new body began to feel comfortably familiar again, to the point where it required an effort of will to remind herself of its novelty. She buried herself in her work, pushed the limits of endurance, but despite early progress in several areas, soon all avenues of investigation came to dead ends. The black cube remained stubbornly enigmatic. Even the gleaming new tools of pre-cut-off science could only scratch the surface of its mystery, and they'd learned depressingly little more than had been gleaned by Svetlana's first fumbling probings. The best working hypothesis was still that it was some kind of massively advanced replicating technology, endlessly self-repairing, running on a substrate far finer than the atomic granularity of the Chinese nanotech in the forge vats. Nuclear-scale femtotech, perhaps, or even some kind of replicating machinery cobbled together from the basic structural units of space-time. Working with such materials would, Nick Thale had told her, be akin to trying to build a functioning lathe out of wet spaghetti. Such difficulties clearly hadn't daunted the cube's creators. She still had no better idea who they had been. Nothing in the pre-cut-off history files hinted at any human faction with the means to make something like the cube. And even if that had been possible, there was still the awkward question of how they had placed it into orbit around Janus. Never mind what they had intended by that. Now and then Bella went along to the research lab where Ofria Gomberg and the others were studying the cube. It was a white room, sunk deep in a bunker. Caged between sensors, the cube stood out like an offcut of sculpted granite in an upmarket gallery. Something about the cube still touched an ominous chord in her, as if it was trying to pull her in, whispering something to her hindbrain. She could only compare the feeling to the dark allure of dockside water, that seductive force that compelled people to fall in. She did not want to fall into the black cube. She was afraid of what it would show her. The ongoing inquiry into the death of Meredith Bagley had also ground to a halt after a promising start. Bella was still convinced that she had identified the three perpetrators, but had lost faith that the suit repair log was enough of a smoking gun to convince a tribunal of their involvement. Hank Dusson was out of reach, but she still intended to bring the two surviving men to justice. Morbidly, it occurred to her that if either of the two suspects showed any sign of dying before the investigation had run its course, she would have to pull strings to get them bounced up the cube for rejuvenation. But the case still demanded more evidence. The repair log alone wouldn't clinch it. The only thing that would really persuade a skeptical tribunal would be the missing EVA log files, showing who had really been on duty during that fatal shift. It was generally accepted that the logs had been lost accidentally, corrupted or deleted in the flexi die-off, but perhaps that was just too convenient. What if the logs had been deleted to protect the killers? Any one of the three men would have had reason to do that, but Bella could not be sure that any of them would have had the means. But someone had been in charge of managing those log files. Perhaps Parry could help her. He'd at least known whether it was feasible for an involved party to have tampered with the logs. She made mental note to contact him. She brightened at the prospect. wondering why it had taken her so long to think of him again. It had always been good to talk to Parry. He had been kind to her during her years of exile, often at the cost of his relationship with Svetlana. Things had obviously changed during the last 20 years, but in their rare meetings, Bella had never sensed any enmity or coolness on Parry's side. He appeared to recognize that it was not Bella that had deposed Svetlana, but the return of Jim Chisholm, and, of course, Bella had been lenient with Svetlana and her allies. None of them had ended up in exile at the end of a superconducting line with only ice and silence for company. She might have marginalized them, stripped them of real power, but she had not treated them unfairly. Even her worst critics could never accuse her of indulging in tit-for-tat, and Parry had never been her worst critic. But something happened the next day, a lander malfunction of all things, and she forgot to call Parry. More days slipped by, then weeks, and a succession of minor crises pushed their way onto her agenda. The Bagley case remained on the back burner, and it would be many years before it once again returned to the forefront of Bella's attention. By then, someone else had come back from the dead. Mike Takahashi awoke to the sound of burbling water and tinkling wind chimes. "Hello," Bella said, with what she hoped was the right tone of soft reassurance. "It's me, Mike. Bella. Everything's okay." She remembered how it had been for her, a moment's disorientation, and then everything had clicked cleanly into place. No grogginess, no sense of fumbling around for her own sense of identity, no difficulty with coherent thought or language or even seeing things clearly. It was not like waking up at all, but more like opening her eyes after a few moments of intense meditation, except that those few moments of meditation had contained infinities of time and space, and mysteries she had not even begun to unpack. Takahashi moved to sit up. Bella offered him a blanket to preserve his modesty. "Where am I?" he asked, looking around. He sounded mildly perturbed, that was all. "I don't remember this place." "I'm not sure what you do remember," Bella said, "but let's start at the beginning. Do you remember Rockhopper?"
"Yes," he said immediately. "Of course I do." "And Janus?"
A moment of hesitation there, but it didn't last long.
"Yes," he said, "I do.
We were chasing after it, powering out of the system. Do you remember that?" He looked at her and said, so quietly that she had to strain to hear him over the water,
"Something went wrong. I remember something going wrong."
"Yes," she said, gladdened, because it was all going to be so much easier now.
"There was a problem with one of the mass drivers. It snapped off the spine and took another one with it on the way down. The ship held together, but there was a lot of superficial damage to the fuel tanks. We had to patch things up before we could continue to Janus at full thrust. You were part of the repair team, Mike."
"Something happened," he said. "Something bad. Do you remember?"
She caught a flash of concern, as if he had for a moment remembered everything. But then he shook his head.
"No. What happened? Why am I here?"
He glanced down at himself.
"I'm all right, aren't I?"
"You're more than all right," Bella said, smiling. The fountainheads had put him back together, but they had not rejuvenated him to any significant degree. There had been no need. He had been a young and healthy man when the spray rock took him.
"I still don't remember what happened," he said forlornly. "You fell into spray rock. You were trapped. Your suit overheating. We couldn't get you out of it. Parry did everything he could, but nothing worked, and time was running out."
"Parry," he said, "is Parry okay?"
"Parry's fine. You'll see him soon. What happened to me?"
Bella reached for his hand, closing her own around it. She had never had a son, but this, she thought, must be very much how it would feel to comfort a son during an emotional crisis.
"We had to do something to you. There was a procedure that we could use to save you. It was called Frost Angel. Do you remember that?"
"No,"
he said, but she caught the dilation of his eyes that told her that he did, on some level, remember all the salient details. They had never been sure how much of the experience of the accident would have had time to transfer to his long-term memory.
"Ryan Axford froze you. He had no choice. It was the right thing to do."
"No,"
Takahashi said, Bella feeling his distress welling up as the memory slotted back into place.
No, I didn't want to die.
There was no choice, she said. We had to do it. Takahashi convulsed, the truth hitting him like a drug.
No, I didn't die. This didn't happen.
You died, Mike, she said, as firmly as she thought he could handle, but we brought you back. It's all okay now.
No,
he said again, but he was slightly calmer now.
You're fine. Everything's all right now.
He shivered beneath the blanket.
Where am I?
In a ship, Bella said. He looked around, but there was nothing overtly alien about the revival area. Bella had even asked the aliens to tint the glass and not to present themselves behind it. There was only so much Takahashi could take in at one time. She wanted to make it as easy as she could. She'd always liked him, from the moment he rotated aboard Rockhopper. He was a solid EVA man, as dependable as any of them. But there was more to Mike Takahashi than his professional competence. There was a quiet modesty about him that she found attractive, a quality that she'd also cherished in Garrison. The two of them had the same way of laughing.
After Janus, he said warily, did we make it back okay?
Bella smiled tightly. This part was never going to be easy. She nodded towards a small pile of clothes folded neatly on a dry rock, like a miniature kiln. Most of Takahashi's belongings had long since been recycled. There simply hadn't been any choice in the dark days of the early occupation, but they had always kept a few things back, as a kind of assurance that he would one day return to them. The clothes were very old now, but they had been well cared for, and their age was not obvious.
Get dressed, she said. Then I'll tell you everything you need to know.
Takahashi tightened the blanket around himself.
What happened to Janus?
We did, Bella said, and then she helped him stand. She told him what had happened, ladling out the truth in kind little measures, as she had always done for the people of Crabtree. At every opportunity she reassured him that he had nothing to fear, that everything was all right, and that he had many, many friends who would be overjoyed to see him again. Takahashi said very little. Now and then he would repeat something that she had said, or ask her for some mild clarification on this matter or that, but in general he appeared emotionally disconnected from it all.
Just like the Swiss Family Robinson, she said,
after she'd finished telling him about their arrival on Janus and the early hardships they had overcome. Takahashi didn't laugh. They were riding the express elevator to Underhole, racing down a glass tube lined with chrome-bright maglev induction rails. They had the entire compartment to themselves, save for the eternally vigilant security systems haunting every cubic millimeter of the car's decor. But that all happened a long time ago, Bella said. We rode Janus all the way to Spiker. 13 years that took us. For most of that time we were moving very close to the speed of light. 260 years passed in the outside world. Bella had dimmed the cabin lights so that they could see the view beyond the car. It was always dark under the iron sky. Underhole sprawled beneath them, a jeweled octopus of light, each of its arms tracing a different maglev line from somewhere else on Janus. Although the train still arrived and departed from the same transit plaza, new developments continued to spill out along the tracks. The lines themselves curved out to the horizon in 8 directions, glowing with the blue filaments of embedded neon. At one time, the wastage of so much power would have appalled Bella. It was years since anyone had worried about a few lost kilowatts, though.
You didn't do all this in 13 years, Takahashi said.
No, Bella conceded. It took a bit longer than that.
How long?
After 13 years, the aliens came. He nodded. He had needed to be told about the Fountainheads before anything else, although he hadn't seen them yet.
How long ago was that?
35 years, Bella said, which makes this the 48th year of the human occupation. We've been on Janus for almost 50 years. There are nearly 500 of us now. He looked at her wonderingly.
How old would that make you, Bella?
Too old to answer that question, she said, not quite able to meet his gaze. Actually, it would make me more than 100 years old, which is sometimes how old I feel. She paused, anticipating his next question. When I was 88, which was 15 years ago, I went to the fountainheads. They made me young again, set my body clock back to about the same age I was when we met Janus. You don't look much older now than you did then. Takahashi wasn't the type to dole out insincere flattery. Plus, she had mirrors. She knew how she looked. I should look 70, I suppose, but clearly I don't. I look a little older than when I walked out of the Fountainhead ship 15 years ago, but not by that much. She held up her hand. For the first time I can feel the arthritis coming back. If it hadn't happened to me already, I doubt I'd recognize the signs. He studied her with unconcealed fascination. My memory isn't all there yet, Bella, but I remember that you were alone on the ship. Yes, she said simply. I'm guessing that's changed after all these years, right? She answered sharply. I'm still alone. But it's been... He shook his head in amazement. Wasn't there anyone, Bella? She could have lied to him and to herself, but Takahashi deserved better than that. I tried to make it work with someone once. He was a good man, one of the best in Crabtree, for a few months. He must have mistaken something in her voice. What happened to him? Nothing. He's still around. We just couldn't make it work. I'm sorry. Don't be. It's my fault. I dragged too much of the past around with me. After a long silence, as the elevator slowed into the transit plaza in Underhole, with its concourse ramps and rows of boutiques and restaurants, Takahashi said, "Will they make you young again?" "They had better," Bella said. "There's still work to do." Takahashi's good progress continued. In the 6th week, Bella decided that it was safe to introduce him back into the colony. She chose to arrange a party in his honor. It took place in Crabtree's largest arboretum. It was evening. The ceiling lights had been turned down from their daytime glare, and false stars sprinkled the strutted canopy. The largest trees had been strung with lines of paper lanterns in reds and golds and greens. Choral music floated from concealed speakers. Bella had chosen Arvo Pärt from the files because she had discovered one of the Estonian composer's recordings amongst Takahashi's personal belongings. She had considered it vital not to exclude anyone from the party, and consequently almost every adult citizen who could make it was there. They circled and talked in the still-scented air of a midsummer night. Hovering lanterns followed little groups, offering them light until they were shooed away good-naturedly. B.I. robots maintained a discreet presence, only emerging from the darkness between the trees to offer drinks, sweetmeats, and the occasional helping hand. Bella was too nervous to fully enjoy the party herself, but as the evening wore on, it gradually began to dawn on her that it was not going to be the abject failure she had feared. Takahashi was easy with a sudden flood of attention, moving comfortably from one group to the next, telling the same stories over and over again, laughing patiently at the same well-intentioned jokes. Now and then he would retire to a convenient tree stump for a few moments to himself, but whenever Bella talked to him, he assured her that he was going to be fine, and that he was rather enjoying the whole affair. He was enchanted with the variety of costumes on parade, 80 years of fashion history that he had never lived through. Despite the collision of styles, the evening ambience and the soft light from the lanterns lent everything a subtle unity. "How do you like the music?" Bella asked, as they sat together with only a hovering lantern between them. "We found your old helmet, looked through the access statistics in the file memory. You used to listen to this a lot." "It's great. The main thing is that it isn't Puccini." "Puccini? I died while listening to Turandot. How many people can say that?" Bella put a hand on his knee. "I know this isn't all going to be easy for you, Mike, but you'll get there in the end. You're a miner." "Pushing ice," he said, a touch too confidently to be convincing. She noticed that he had been watching a young woman standing at the edge of a nearby group, her luminous, neon-patterned gown scooped low on her back, revealing more than it hid. The lantern light played softly over her shoulders and the incurve of her spine. Bella tried to remember the woman's name, but nothing came. "You didn't have to go to all this trouble just for me," Takahashi said. "I think we did. Not that I don't appreciate it, but does everyone get this attention when they come back?" "You were different," Bella said, gently chiding. "We never expected to get you back. That made it worth celebrating. You've all been through such hard times.
I almost feel like a fraud, as if I've missed out on all the hard work.
You shouldn't feel that way. In fact, I'll make a point of being cross with you if I even suspect that's how you feel.
Takahashi accepted a BI's offer to refill his wine glass. The glasses had been spun in the forge vats, miracles of crystalline delicacy, the stems braided from dozens of filaments of whisker-thin glass like the vapor trail of a corkscrewing fighter jet.
"When you brought me down from the ship," he said, meaning the Fountainhead Embassy, "you told me there had been a difference of opinion on Rockhopper, that it hadn't been a unanimous decision to come here. That was all a long time ago. No sense in going over old ground. I heard you brought Rockhopper here, that it was your decision not to try to return home. What do you think you would have done?"
Takahashi looked through his glass at the attractive woman. "At the time, I doubt that I'd have gone along with it, but in retrospect, I think you did the right thing. You'd never have made it back. Deep Shaft and the UEE would never have put together a rescue plan. Hindsight is a wonderful thing. It's just a pity not everyone saw it that way at the time. Svetlana put you in prison. She punished you for saving us."
Bella felt a tightness in her throat. She hardly ever talked about her exile now, or the spite that had caused it.
"Svieta had her reasons," she said, savoring the pious little thrill that came with magnanimity. "Had I listened to her, we would probably never have made it into the slipstream in the first place.
You had equally compelling reasons not to do as she asked."
"Yes," Bella said, "but it was still a mistake. I hope I redeemed myself later, but..."
She trailed off. To say anything more in her defense would have been distasteful.
"It cost you your friendship with Svieta," Takahashi said. "We used to see things similarly. I considered her a good friend." She paused, watching the orbiting groups of partygoers.
"But friendships are always difficult to maintain across lines of rank, even in a civilian organization. It was a wonder ours lasted as long as it did." She shrugged, trying to make out that it was no great thing to her anymore.
"How long has it been since you last spoke to her?"
Bella smiled. It was not a difficult question.
"We haven't exchanged a word since Rockhopper landed on Janus."
He shook his head in appalled fascination.
"That's as long as I've been dead."
"Yes," she said. "I suppose it is.
It isn't right, Bella."
She felt then the first hint of irritation with him. What business did he have coming back from the dead and lecturing her? But she fought to keep it from her voice.
"Mike,
it was not because I didn't try. I wasn't asking for our friendship back. I wasn't even asking for her to talk to me or send a letter. I just wanted her to offer me one tiny shred of human dignity, the smallest acknowledgement that I could be something other than the force for evil she obviously considered me. But nothing came."
"Do you think she hates you?"
"All I know is that when an intense friendship ends, this is often what happens." Takahashi swirled his wine. "I don't think men have those kinds of friendships. I mean, not unless they're lovers. I've never had such an intense friendship with another man. One guy, I crewed with him for 8 years, helped him suit up, ran EVA shifts with him, got drunk with him, and yet all that time went by before I even found out he was married." He laughed, shaking his head, knowing that stuff about each other wasn't even on our interpersonal radar. "And yet we were as good a pair of EVA buddies as I've ever known."
"What was his name?"
"Can't remember."
They sat in silence for several minutes, alone with their thoughts. Bella smoked a cigarette. It was the first she'd allowed herself in weeks. Groups of partygoers mingled in the lantern light, faces aglow with the pleasant intoxication of good drink on a glamorous evening. Just a glimpse of this evening would have sustained her through the darkest days of her exile. Takahashi pointed to a sandy-haired boy standing with a party of adults.
"Who's the kid?"
"Axford." Takahashi frowned.
"Axford had a kid?"
"No," Bella said patiently. "The kid is Axford. He had the full reset the last time he went up."
"You trust a kid to look after you now?"
"The kid still has Axford's memories and adult experience. He thinks like a man, just happens to look like a little boy. Axford told me he'd put off going skyside for so long that he didn't want to have to go back for many, many years." Mischievously, Bella added, "Besides, he says his hands can slip into surgical openings they could never fit through before."
"Did they, you know, fix him?"
Bella feigned puzzlement.
"Fix him, Mike?" In what way?
Axford was gay.
Axford is still gay, as far as I know. I don't think he saw it as something that particularly needed fixing.
Okay, Takahashi said, shrugging.
He's still Axford, Mike. He's just more efficiently packaged. You get used to it in the end. When I look at him now, I hardly remember what the old Axford used to look like.
One group dispersed, and in the sudden opening of a sightline, she saw Svetlana, standing 20 or 30 paces away, her back to Bella, talking to Parry Boyce and a young couple she couldn't name. She experienced no shock at seeing Svetlana. She had been invited, or rather had not been deliberately excluded, and there had always been an excellent chance that she would attend. Takahashi's return was as much part of her world as Bella's, after all. But Bella still felt uncomfortable to see her. This was the closest they had been in nearly 50 years. They were in the same room at last, even if it was the huge enclosure of the Arboretum. Had they wished, they could have called out to each other.
You saw her as well, Takahashi said in a low, conspiratorial voice.
I'm not surprised. I never exiled her. I never forbade her from setting foot in Crabtree.
Are the two of you going to say anything to each other?
I think we've said all that needs to be said.
Svetlana started to look back over her shoulder, as if she had become aware of Bella's guarded scrutiny. In profile, she looked older than Bella remembered, even allowing for the flattering effect of the lantern light, but not 50 years older. Svetlana had visited the Fountainheads at least once, as had Parry. Like Bella, the clothes she wore were of antique cut, loose denim jeans, cowboy boots, a t-shirt and a brown leather jacket slung over one shoulder. Her red hair was cut spikily short, catching the lantern light. There was a moment when they might have been close to making eye contact, when another group of celebrants blocked her view. A tumbling acrobat, Bella couldn't tell if it was a person or a BI android, flung itself head over heels, its wrists and ankles spitting golden fire. When the tumbler had passed, Svetlana's party had moved on. Takahashi looked up as something huge rumbled towards them along a wide, tree-lined avenue.
Hey, is that...
Yes, Bella said, glad that the awkward moment had passed. It's McKinley. I hoped he'd accept the invitation. The Fountainhead had arrived in a 4-meter-wide transparent sphere containing no visible instruments or life support systems. Muscular waves of his tractor fronds propelled it forward. Bella shuddered to think of the pressure and gravitational forces trapped behind that glass. McKinley must have seen her. He, she had come to think of him as male, rolled to a halt before her, before forming a high-resolution crossweave.
Hi, she said, aware of how ludicrously banal the greeting was given the circumstances.
McKinley tipped himself forward in the Fountainhead approximation of a nod.
Hi yourself, and hello to Mike as well.
The voice was louder and more human in texture than she remembered, but perhaps that had something to do with the acoustic amplification of the mobility sphere.
Hi, Takahashi said, raising a hand.
The alien turned the crossweave towards him.
It's good to see you up and about.
It's good to be up and about, Takahashi said. Don't let anyone tell you differently. Being dead is no party.
No walk in the woods, McKinley said, unraveling the crossweave.
Takahashi smiled.
Nor that. Everyone looks very happy to have you back, the alien said. You must have been very popular in your time.
I'll try not to blow it this time around. Takahashi stood up decisively from the stump, glass in hand.
I'm going to mingle for a while. You two stay and chat, and I'll hook up with you later, okay?
Okie dokie, McKinley said. Takahashi patted the glass sphere. And no talking about me behind my back.
Bella watched him stroll into the night until he was absorbed into a gaggle of well-wishers. As much as she enjoyed his presence, she was quietly glad that Takahashi had decided to leave her alone with McKinley.
They're happy for Mike, the alien observed. He was lucky to have someone like you in charge.
We owed it to him.
You'd be surprised how many species don't take such a charitable view of their weaker members, McKinley said, with an idle flick of his tractor fronds.
I knew you were buttering me up for something, she said. That was, incidentally, a very nice segue to the main topic, which I take it has something to do with another species.
You're a shrewd woman, Bella Lind. McKinley made a weird twisting motion that she had not observed amongst his usual repertoire of gestures. It was almost, Bella thought, as if he was checking over his shoulder for eavesdroppers. He lowered his voice until she had to lean forward to hear him above the choral music.
"That matter we discussed a little while ago, prior to your rejuvenation?"
"A little while? That was 15 years ago, McKinley." The human perception of different units of time was still problematic for the Fountainheads. Through their conversations, Bella had come to suspect that the Fountainheads measured time in terms of the density of events, rather than the number of elapsed units of some specific interval. To Fountainheads, 100 years in which nothing much happened was less time than an event-filled minute.
"But you know what I'm talking about," McKinley said.
A BI stalked over, anxious to charge her glass. Bella waved the robot away.
"The musk dogs, I imagine." "I am glad that you remember.
They've been showing renewed interest in this region of the structure. We think their arrival is now imminent." "The last time we talked about this, you defined imminent as anything ranging from years to decades. I don't suppose there's any chance of narrowing it down a bit."
"Now I would be inclined to talk in months. You should be ready for them."
"Perhaps we are. You said it would be bad if we were in a state of social fragmentation, remember?" "Well, maybe we were, then, but we've never been more unified than we are now. Just take a look at this party. There's a representative of every faction on Janus here tonight, and so far I haven't seen any fights breaking out."
"It's certainly encouraging."
"You don't sound convinced."
"When they come, they will find the tiniest rift and open it wide. They will make blood enemies of cool rivals, rivals of the best of friends."
Bella shook her head, exasperated. "Being factional is part of what we are."
"Perhaps you're right," the alien said, with a gloomy note she couldn't miss. "Things are better now, at least.
Perhaps that will make enough of a difference. If the musk dogs are so bad, why don't you just make them go away?"
"We can dissuade them, but only if you ask it of us."
"What does dissuade mean?"
"It means we would emphasize the exclusive nature of the beneficial trading relationship we've established with your people. If musk dogs see no potential for undermining that mutually productive state of affairs, they will probably leave."
The Fountainhead paused and added darkly, "Sooner or later, another vulnerable species will arrive. They always do, even if the intervals grow longer."
"So we're just another vulnerable species?" she asked.
"You have your weaknesses, but like most newcomers, you also have something immensely valuable to those of us already here.
The world we rode in on.
You're making quite a home of it."
"We're making do, McKinley. That doesn't mean we plan to spend the rest of eternity here." His fronds swished thoughtfully.
"It's good to have plans."
Just as he said that, Bella became aware of a presence behind her. She glanced around and saw Mike Takahashi, wine glass in hand. Next to Takahashi, standing a little further back, was Svetlana.
"Mike,"
Bella started, ready to protest at his interference. Takahashi blocked her with his palm.
"If a recently dead man is to be allowed one concession, let it be this. I'm sorry about the feud, or the falling out, or the political schism, or whatever you want to call it. I'm even sorrier that two former friends can't even say hello to each other when they're in the same room. Well, it's time to do something about that, before it puts too much of a dampener on the evening."
"This was a bad idea," Svetlana said, not looking at Bella.
"I agree," Bella said.
She was blushing intensely, even though she had drunk little all evening.
"Mike, I know you mean well, but this isn't just some playground spat you can put right with a sprinkling of fairy dust and some good intentions."
Takahashi sipped from his glass.
"Fine, but just out of interest, how long were you two planning on holding this grudge? Another 50 years? A century? Or will you just be getting started then?"
"There is no grudge," Bella said. She was uncomfortably aware of McKinley taking all this in. Takahashi turned to Svetlana.
"I spoke to Bella earlier this evening. She admitted that you had your reasons for taking over the ship. She made a mistake, a bad one, in not listening to you. She doesn't deny that."
"A mistake is still a mistake," Svetlana said, her lips barely moving.
"Which she freely acknowledges. But given that she made that mistake, given the situation Rockhopper was then in,
Can you honestly deny that she did the right thing by forcing the ship back to Janus?
That doesn't make amends, Svetlana said.
Takahashi held up his hand again.
There's more you need to hear, Svieta.
When I spoke to Bella earlier, she was, how shall I put this, not without praise for the way you ran Crabtree? He looked to Bella for confirmation. She blushed again, for this, as Takahashi surely knew, was an outright lie. And yet, in private, in the most grudging of tones, she might have admitted as much.
We all did our best, Svetlana said, looking at Bella properly for the first time.
Bella reached deep into herself, groping around for something nice to say.
It can't have been easy, especially during those first few years, before the Moor came on stream.
We got through it, Svetlana said tersely.
It took leadership.
Svetlana looked at Bella, held her gaze, and nodded just so. The acknowledgement was as frostily diplomatic as they came, but it was more than Bella had expected.
Thank you, Svetlana mouthed.
Takahashi's eyes gleamed in the lantern light.
Svetlana, for her part, admits that you've handled things very capably since you returned to Crabtree. Your management of the symbolists was an exercise in tact and restraint.
He glanced at Svetlana.
Wasn't it?
You did okay, she said after a moment's pause. Svetlana also had a degree of praise for the way you refrained from exiling your former adversaries. Rather than indulging in petty recrimination, you put the needs of the colony first.
Bella still marginalized us, Svetlana said.
That was her prerogative, but I can't help noticing that she did invite you along tonight.
I suppose so.
Bella ventured, I thought you'd like to see Mike again. Now I'm beginning to wonder why I invited him.
Yes, Svetlana said, directing an acid glance at Takahashi. It would have saved us both some embarrassment if you hadn't.
Takahashi nodded, smiling ruefully.
Yes, without my intervention, you two could still be playing your avoidance games, whereas now you've been standing next to each other for 5 minutes already, without a single drop of blood being spilled. Sorry, but where I come from, that has to be considered an improvement.
Not where I come from, Bella said, just as Svetlana said exactly the same thing. They looked at each other and both let out a single, cautious, self-conscious laugh. Then there was nothing to say. The silence was the most exquisitely awkward part of the encounter so far. They could turn away now, Bella thought, having had this brief, bloodless, dignified encounter, and return to their own groupings, and for a while it might seem as if something had changed for the better, but soon things would be exactly the way they had been before. It was now or never to make a change that might stand a chance of lasting. Bella's throat was furnace dry. She opened her mouth, willed words to emerge.
You must be proud of Emily, she said. I see her in Crabtree nearly every day. She's very talented, very beautiful. I don't know anyone who doesn't speak highly of her.
Thank you, Svetlana said, and this time she spoke the words, rather than just grimacing them. Another awkward silence descended, and then Svetlana added, It was kind of you to arrange that line of work for her. Bella glanced at McKinley.
Oh, don't worry about him.
He's fully aware that we have a study group dedicated solely to discovering the secrets of the Fountainheads. If they will insist on dropping little hints every now and then, what do they expect? Bella had observed real analytic skill in Emily Barsegian, and had seen to it that she was rewarded with a position in the coveted Fountainhead Intelligence section. There had been disappointingly few breakthroughs, but none of that failure could be placed at Emily's door.
She enjoys it, Svetlana said.
I knew she would. I see a lot of you in her. Bella offered a half smile.
Maybe a little of me, too.
I could never do what she does, Svetlana said. I'm still just an engineer at heart. Recklessly, Bella said, Crabtree always needs good engineers.
I'm still keeping busy.
Yes, Bella thought, dead-end spanner work, a long way from anything interesting. But maybe I could have made better use of you. I must admit I didn't go out of my way to involve you in the most exciting projects. You've been to Underhole recently, I take it? You've seen the Tier 2 development.
I haven't been on the other side of the sky in 35 years, Svetlana said.
This is only the third time I've been back to Crabtree in all that time.
I'm sorry, Bella said.
as the magnitude of that span of time hit her with physical force. You don't need to apologize. At least you didn't lock me away for 13 years. For what it's worth. I made a mistake, okay? But right now that's the closest you're going to get to an apology. I'll take whatever's going. And I screwed you over the Chisholm affair. If it's any consolation, that's one of the things I'm least proud of. Something changed in her expression, a closing up, as if she realized that she had said too much, too quickly. Look, she went on, I really should be getting back. I'm glad we talked, Bella. If you'd have asked me this morning, well, I'd never have believed we could be talking like this. But it's time to go now. No, Bella said firmly. Stay. I want to talk to you. I'm not done yet, Sveta. You're not done. No, and neither are you. Bella looked around. Look, let's find somewhere quiet to sit down. Just the two of us. No Takahashi, no McKinley. All right, Svetlana said uneasily, as if she still did not quite trust Bella's motives. Svetlana had nothing in her hand. Do you want a drink? Bella asked. I'd offer you a cigarette, but as far as I remember, you don't smoke. I'll take a drink. Yes, Svetlana said. Bella snapped her fingers at the nearest BI. Over here, she called.